The train left the town behind before Ren had properly registered that she was leaving it. She watched the station platform shrink through the glass pane, three figures standing in the gray light, a stack of wooden crates, the skeletal outline of the water tower, and then the landscape folded itself into trees and then into nothing. Her reflection in the window was pale and indistinct, a ghost superimposed over the passing fields. She pressed her palm flat against the cold surface and felt the vibration of the tracks travel up her arm, a steady, rhythmic hum that matched the throbbing behind her eyes. She had not cried at the reading of the will. She had not cried when they lowered the casket into the damp earth. Now, 3 days into the journey back, with the air growing thicker and warmer with every mile, the tears came without warning. She wiped them away with the back of her hand, angry at the betrayal of her own body. Grief was a discipline, her father had once told her, something to be managed like a ledger. You allocated your sorrow in portions, you balanced the books, and you kept the accounts clear. But the ledger was closed now, and Ren was alone with the silence. The carriage was nearly empty. A farmer in a worn cap slept in the corner, his mouth open, a string of saliva catching the dusty light. An elderly woman knitted something gray and shapeless, the needles clicking a slow counter-rhythm to the wheels. Ren stared out at the blurring green, counting the seconds between the telegraph poles, trying to anchor herself in the tangible mathematics of distance and time. 300 miles from the city, 12 hours on the railway, one lifetime of debt. When the train finally slowed, the air that seeped through the cracked window was heavy, saturated with moisture and the scent of decaying vegetation. It was a smell she remembered from childhood: wet earth, rotting leaves, the deep fungal musk of the swampy ground that surrounded the town. It was the smell of things left to decompose in the dark. Oakhaven Station was smaller than she recalled. A single wooden platform, warped and splintered, stretching out beneath a corrugated iron roof that groaned in the wind. The station master, a young man with a face too smooth for his age, stepped forward to help her with her trunk. He took the handle, his grip firm, and Ren felt a sudden, sharp pang of recognition. His hands were broad, his fingers thick-jointed. She had seen those hands before, moving with the same deliberate care over brass fittings and polished wood. "You're Holloway?" the station master asked. "Ren Holloway," she said. Her voice sounded foreign to her own ears, flat and clipped. Uncle Silas had sent a carriage. He had been waiting since morning. Ren nodded. She had expected Silas to meet her, though she had not told him she was coming until the telegram 3 days prior. The news of her father's illness had reached her in Birmingham, carried by a letter written in a hand that trembled so badly the ink had bled into the paper. "Come home," it had said. "The accounts are a mess." She had packed her bags that night, told her landlord she was leaving, and caught the first train south. She had imagined a quick visit, a few days of sitting by the bedside, a funeral, and then the return to her life in the city. But the train ride had given her time to think, and the thinking had given her fear. The carriage was a black landau, the paint peeling in strips along the fenders. Silas stood beside it, leaning against the driver's seat with an ease that suggested he had been born to this posture. He was a large man, broad-shouldered and solid, wearing a dark coat that strained across his chest. His gray hair was swept back from a forehead that was already beginning to recede, and his green eyes caught the dull light as he straightened up to greet her. "Well," he said, his voice booming in the empty station, "you look like her. God, you look exactly like her." He reached for her trunk before she could refuse. Ren stepped back, taking the handle from his grip. "I can manage, thank you," she said. Silas smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes. Of course, I'm just eager to get you home. The house, well, it's been quiet, too quiet." They drove through the town in silence. Oakhaven had not changed. The same brick buildings lined the main street, their facades stained with soot and time. The same shop windows displayed the same wares, dry goods, boots, jars of pickled vegetables behind glass that needed washing. The same people walked the sidewalks, their faces turned down against the wind, their hands buried deep in their pockets. Ren noticed everything. Children kicked at broken bottles in the gutters, glass crunching under their boots. Women pulled their shawls tighter around their necks, fingers twisting the wool. Men stood in groups outside the pub, their faces grim, their voices low. The funeral home stood on the edge of town, where the paved road gave way to gravel and the houses became smaller, more crowded together. It was a Victorian structure, tall and narrow, with a steep gable roof and a wraparound porch that sagged slightly on the left side. The paint was white, but it was a dirty white, yellowed by decades of sun and rain. The windows were dark, as if the house had closed its eyes against the world. Silas pulled the carriage to a halt in front of the steps. He climbed down and offered her his hand, which she ignored as she lifted herself down. The gravel crunched beneath her boots, a harsh sound in the stillness. "Welcome home," Silas said. The front door was unlocked. Ren pushed it open, and the smell hit her immediately: formaldehyde, stale lilies, and something else, something metallic and old, like blood dried on copper. The foyer was dim, the light filtering through the dust-covered windows in thin, gray beams. A grand staircase rose to the left, its banister polished to a dull shine by years of passing hands. To the right, a doorway led into the parlor, where two black-draped chairs sat empty, facing the fireplace. "It's exactly as he left it," Silas said, stepping inside and closing the door behind them. The click of the latch was loud in the silence. "I've kept things running, routine services, two cremations last week, a burial on Tuesday, nothing major." Ren hung her coat on the hook by the door. The wood was warm beneath her fingers, worn smooth by her father's touch. "I'll need to see the books, Uncle Silas, the ledger, all of them." Silas's smile tightened at the corners. "Of course, the office is through here." He led her down a short corridor to a small room at the back of the house. The office was exactly as she remembered: a heavy oak desk, a leather chair that had been patched with tape, shelves lined with ledgers and files, and a window that looked out onto the embalming room. On the desk sat a single ledger, its cover cracked and faded, its pages yellowed with age. Ren approached the desk and placed her hand on the ledger. The leather was cool and slightly sticky beneath her fingertips. "I want to go through everything," she said. "Every entry, every transaction." Silas leaned against the doorframe, crossing his arms. "Ren, you've just arrived, you're tired. Permit me to show you the highlights first. Your father was meticulous, the business was stable. There's no need to." "There is always a need," Ren said. She opened the ledger. The first page was dated 20 years ago. The handwriting was her father's, neat, precise, angular. The entries were listed in columns: date, name of the deceased, service type, cost, payment received. And then in a separate column to the right, smaller and less legible, were other notes: ash mix, mill delivery, balance transferred. "What are these notes?" Ren asked, pointing to the marginalia. Silas followed her gaze and stiffened. "Just internal reminders, inventory codes. Your father used shorthand." Ren turned the page. The entries continued year after year, decade after decade. The numbers grew larger. The notes grew more frequent: 47 units delivered, Q3 surplus, mill contract renewed. "I want to see the rest of the files," she said, "the ones that aren't in this book." Silas pushed himself off the doorframe and stepped into the room. He moved to the shelves and ran his fingers along the spines of the binders. "Those are mostly old records, predating my involvement. Your father handled them himself. He was very protective of his privacy." Ren's finger stopped on a spine 1898-1903, and she drew it half an inch from the shelf. Silas's hand closed over hers, firm but not unkind. She withdrew it slowly, deliberately, and turned the page she'd been on instead. Silas crossed his arms again, his jaw tightening. "Ren, listen to me. This house, this business, it's all we have left. Your father worked hard to keep it afloat. Through the Depression, through the war, through everything, he made sacrifices, hard choices. And now that he's gone, I need you to understand that some things are best left undisturbed. Some doors shouldn't be opened." Ren set the ledger flat on the desk and pressed her palm flat against its cover, a gesture of finality, not threat. She met his eyes and held them until he looked away first. Silas pressed away from the frame and entered the chamber. He approached the shelving and traced his fingertips along the leather bindings. "These are largely archival matters, predating my tenure. Your father managed them personally. He was exceedingly guarded regarding his affairs." "I'm not asking about his privacy, Uncle Silas. I'm asking about the business." Silas turned to face her. His green eyes were hard, his jaw set. "Ren, heed my warning. This house, this business, it is all we have left. Your father worked tirelessly to keep the enterprise solvent, surviving the lean years of the Depression and the turmoil of the war alike. He gave up much, made grave decisions, And now that he is gone, I need you to understand that some matters are best left undisturbed. Some doors should remain shut." Ren looked at him, really looked at him, and saw the tension in his hands, the slight tremor in his left finger. She saw the fear beneath the bluster, the desperation beneath the authority. "Some doors," she said slowly, "are already open." She closed the ledger and picked it up. It was heavier than she expected. "I'm going to rest," she said. "Tomorrow we begin." Silas held her gaze for a long moment, then nodded. "Tomorrow, yes, rest well, Ren." He left the room, closing the door softly behind him. Ren stood alone in the office, the ledger heavy in her arms, the silence of the house pressing in around her. She could hear the faint hum of the embalming fluids circulating in the pipes behind the walls, a low, constant vibration that seemed to resonate in her teeth. She walked to the window and looked out into the embalming room. The tiles were white, but stained with patches of brown and yellow. The steel table gleamed dully in the light, its drains clogged with debris. She set the ledger on the desk and opened it again, turning to a random page. The entry was dated 15 years ago. Elias Holloway. Payment received. 47 units. Mill ash substitute approved. Ren traced the words with her finger. Mill ash substitute approved. The handwriting was steady, confident, her father's hand, her father's decision. Outside, the wind picked up, rattling the window panes in their frames. Ren closed the ledger and placed it back on the shelf. She would not look at it again tonight. She would sleep, and she would wake, and she would begin. But for now, she stood in the dim light of the office, listening to the house breathe, feeling the weight of the past settle onto her shoulders like a shroud. The silence in the room was heavy, pressing against Ren Holloway's ears until she could hear the faint, dry creak of the floorboards settling beneath her weight. She stood alone in the study where her father had kept his accounts, staring at the ledgers that now seemed less like records and more like confessions. For the first time, she allowed herself to feel the terrifying possibility that the foundation of her life was not stone, but something far more fragile, and that the crack forming within it would soon split the world in two.